Not only in America, today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Donald Trump has gotten a lot of mileage out of his strong anti-immigration, anti-Muslim rhetoric. Same with Geert Wilders in the Netherlands.
He's talked about banning the Quran, stopping Muslim immigration. All of this will resonate with an American audience who have heard very similar sentiments from Donald Trump.
Here at home, some are worried about the lasting effects on American democracy.
Trump has unleashed real demons, and once they're out, they're very hard to put back again. He's really set in motion something quite dangerous, and I think we're going to be paying for it for a long time.
Plus, people in the United Arab Emirates get plenty of sunshine, but still not enough vitamin D. Find out why today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Glad you can make it here. And don't fret, in a week and a day, you won't have to hear me or any number of other people in the press saying how much longer till the election is done. That is, at least until the next round of campaigning. I'm getting way ahead of myself, though. Today on the show, we'll hear what some of the lasting consequences could be of the 2016 campaigns. We'll also hear how we're not alone in the divisiveness that's marked this election. So let's start with a closer look at another country where they're gearing up for a vote and where a candidate has also been making headlines with anti-immigrant rhetoric. Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. Wilders was due to go on trial today, but he didn't show up. My BBC colleague Anna Holligan in Amsterdam is following his story.
He is accused of inciting racial hatred. So these charges relate to a political rally back in 2014. He was addressing a cafe full of supporters in The Hague, and he asked them, "Would you like more or fewer Moroccans in the Netherlands?" And the crowd chants back, "Fewer, fewer, fewer." And he replies, "We will arrange that then." Now, they say that this broke the rules in terms of freedom of speech. Geert Wilders has been talking about it. He says that he is simply representing the view of millions of Dutch citizens. He was exercising his right to free speech, and that the comments should be judged in Parliament, not in court at this high security court in Schiphol.
What do the Dutch actually feel about Moroccan immigration to their country?
That's a very good question. According to the prosecutors, he simply took his political agenda too far, that he pushed the boundaries of free speech over the edge. He went from targeting a religion, and he's talked a lot in the past about Islam. He's called for a ban on the Quran, a ban on mosques, on headscarves in the Netherlands. But this time they say he crossed a line. He went too far in targeting an entire ethnic group. And what's really interesting, when you look at his comments and his statements, and he actually tweeted 5 minutes before the trial began to essentially say he wasn't backing down. He believed in what he'd said, and that 43%, he said, of the Dutch population agreed with him. It's a message that resonates with a big proportion of Dutch society who do feel as though immigration is out of control. And he's also pushing this anti-establishment message too.
So he's got this trial today, but he's not attending it. What could this mean for him, and why is he not there?
So he says that this is a political trial. He's referred to it as a travesty, and he says he will not cooperate. He was represented in court earlier by his lawyers and an empty chair. And in fact, he released a statement ahead of this trial. We can hear a little bit of that now.
"It is my right and my duty as a politician to speak about the problems in our country, because the Netherlands has a huge problem with Moroccans. I will always keep expressing my opinion on behalf of millions of Dutch citizens, whatever the consequences."
The kind of populist, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim message that Geert Wilders is proposing sounds familiar to American ears, I imagine. Are there parallels in Geert Wilders with the rise of Donald Trump?
Marco, you would not believe the amount of political analysts who have made that comparison. The people who I've been speaking to over the last couple of days, they say the similarities are striking, right down to the eccentricity and the hair that is often subject of ridicule. Geert Wilders has very distinctive peroxide dyed hair as well. It goes much further, though, than the aesthetics. He is, similar to Trump, very critical of the press, who he says are against him. In a similar way to Donald Trump, he makes use of social media a lot to make sure that his voice is heard by people without being filtered through the media. And in terms of politics, anti-immigration, he's talked about banning the Quran, stopping Muslim immigration. All of this will resonate with an American audience who have heard very similar sentiments from Donald Trump.
My BBC colleague, Anna Holligan, in Amsterdam. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
One thing is certain about this year's election campaign here in the U.S. It's shown that a large slice of the American population is angry and disillusioned with mainstream politics on both the right and the left. A new article by George Packer in The New Yorker argues that the Democratic Party has lost the white working class. We just heard about what's going on in the Netherlands, so I asked Packer where else he's seen this sort of populist political trend on display recently.
The Brexit vote in the U.K., is this voice in a different accent? The National Front voters in France, you could even say that Putin is tapping into the same sort of nationalistic, aggressive, anti-elite, anti-globalist feeling that a lot of the Western working class has. It's not just the American working class, because over the last 30, 40 years, according to recent data, that's the group of people who've done worst in the world, really, in the new era of mobile capital and global economic flux and jobs moving around and technology making it easier. So this is a long time coming, a backlash against a globalized economy that left out large numbers of people in the Western democracies who had been kind of at the center of their country's politics for a long time.
So it's the book by Thomas Friedman, The Lexus and the Olive Tree. It's kind of a roadmap of the glories of globalization. Your take on it is a neat summary of the winners and losers in globalization. Who's won and who's lost?
Well, the winners are the 1% in the West, who were made famous by Occupy Wall Street, and that's not just here, but in Europe as well, and the Asian middle and upper classes. Globalization has done wonderful things for people in poor countries in bringing them closer to the level of the West. It has begun to equalize economic outcomes across the globe, but it has made outcomes within Western countries less equal. And so politics is reflecting that. And that's who the losers are, the working classes, mainly the industrial working classes, who are now in this new service economy, which doesn't have the same kinds of jobs, the same levels of income. Their wages have been stagnant for decades. And what we're seeing, I think, is a political rebellion.
So the evolution of what we have here in the United States, same evolution if you look at France and the support of the far right, leader Marine Le Pen, and same deal in the UK with the Brexit voters?
It's never exactly the same because there's always local factors at play. I mean, what would be the equivalent of the European Union in the United States? Maybe Washington is our Brussels, but there are similarities. And my basic point is that this year, the U.S. has taken a big step toward international politics. Europeans think of Donald Trump as a uniquely awful American phenomenon. But in fact, Donald Trump sounds a lot like Berlusconi of Italy, former prime minister. He sounds sometimes sounds like Marine Le Pen, sometimes like Nigel Farage. And in that sense, he's a populist of the right who's a familiar figure in Europe, a few steps in the direction of a kind of mild fascism. And similarly, on the left, Bernie Sanders, a socialist, came very close to winning the Democratic Party's nomination. That has never happened in this country. And that, in that sense, too, American politics are becoming more extreme and more European.
So you cite President Obama's remarks at Howard University's commencement. He said, "We must expand our moral imaginations to understand and empathize with all people who are struggling, black folks, the refugee, the immigrant, the rural person, the transgender person, and yes, the middle-aged white guy who has seen his world upended by economic and cultural and technological change." So where in the world is there a leader who is managing to unite those disparate groups?
There isn't one that I can see anywhere. Barack Obama gave it a pretty damn good effort. And the speeches he's been giving this year are a remarkable farewell address in which he's kind of leaving behind a marker for what liberal democracy should be and can be. But at the moment, with these class divides, with the false promise of globalization, with the overplaying of America's inspirational power because of the disasters in Iraq and Afghanistan, he's speaking to the future, I think, more than to the present. The present is headed in the other direction. I don't see a single leader anywhere.
A lot of your New Yorker article kind of turns around a lengthy interview you had with Hillary Clinton. Do you think she is up to the task of kind of uniting people if she's elected after November 8th?
It's very hard to imagine that she can do that. She's a polarizing figure, not entirely her own doing. She seems to be a lightning rod for a lot of anger among the electorate, and always has been, really, ever since she became first lady. She doesn't have Obama's philosophical and rhetorical power, and she doesn't have great political instincts. She seems to create problems for herself, as with the emails, and that this has been something that's dogged her for a long time, this kind of failure of deftness in politics. But what she does have is a real seriousness about policy and a lot of good ideas that, if given a chance by Congress and by the public, really could make a difference, I think, in the lives of a lot of struggling Americans who, whether they like her or not, may well find that the country has become a fairer place in a Clinton presidency. But the problem is the politics is so poisoned now that even facts on the ground don't seem to have a whole lot of effect on people's views, which become more and more extreme.
There's social media chatter about a revolt if Hillary Clinton wins, and at least one white terror plot has been broken up in Kansas, I read. How serious are the consequences if Clinton fails to find a way to bring the angry voters back into the political mainstream?
Yeah, I think it won't even be up to her. I think that anger is going to be there the moment she's declared the winner and will be with her for the entirety of her presidency. I would not be surprised, I hate to say it, if there's violence, political violence of a sort, or at least attempts at it. Trump has unleashed real demons, and once they're out, they're very hard to put back again. He's made it almost ignoble to accept a Hillary Clinton victory, that would be to accept, you know, a stolen election. Who could do that in good conscience? So he's really set in motion something quite dangerous, and I think we're going to be paying for it for a long time.
Journalist George Packer has written a must-read for The New Yorker about where we and the rest of the world are at politically. Don't really know any other way of summarizing it. George, thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot, as always, Marco.
Before we take a short break, a quick look at what's coming up later in the show. Our coverage of women's lives across the globe takes us to Colombia this week. Throughout five decades, many women signed up to fight with the FARC rebels. The rebels said they believed in gender equality.
Then you hear about the forced abortions and forced contraception and being forced to sleep with people that you did not necessarily want to, giving up babies that you wished you could raise.
But for those women who've left the FARC, it can be equally hard.
La verdad, usted quiere que yo le diga la verdad,
sí. The truth? You want me to tell you the honest truth?
Yo sí extraño esa vida.
I miss that life.
Esa es la verdad.
That's the truth.
Hashtag balance of power. That's coming up later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Remember Rasputin, Russian peasant, faith healer, and confidant to the last czar of Russia, Nicholas II? Nancy Reagan had astrologist Joan Quigley fill a similar role at the White House. In West Africa, rumors are constantly alive that any number of heads of state consult marabous or shamans. And right now in South Korea, President Park Geun-hye is coming under pressure to step down following revelations that she's been sharing government documents with a Rasputin-like associate, or rather a Rasputina-like associate. Reporter Jason Strother is in Seoul. So lots of anger about this woman, Jason. A huge protest over the weekend in Seoul even. What's going on?
Marco, we had thousands of people take to the streets of the capital over the weekend. Organizers say 20,000 demonstrators came out, some in Halloween costumes dressed as President Park herself, being led on strings by Choi Soon-shil, the woman who is being accused of influence peddling and being a sort of Rasputin-like confidant to the president.
Wow. So not just an advisor, but kind of a puppet master, at least that's how the critics see it. I mean, leaders often seek the counsel of all sorts of advisors. Is this Rasputin comparison really apt?
Well, you know, there are so many rumors going around. Some people refer to her as the shaman, that she has taken the reins of her father's cult and, you know, is involved in some sort of mysticism. I've seen reports on the internet that she helps the president pick out all of her clothes and gives her advice on other daily matters. But what has really gotten the president in trouble is that some South Korean journalists located a computer once owned by Ms. Choi, the influence peddler, and found around a dozen or so speeches that President Park delivered, including a very monumental declaration she made in Germany a few years back on her North Korean policy. And it's unclear how much input Ms. Choi made into these declarations. And this would be a violation. I mean, these are essentially classified documents.
Is this advisor, Ms. Choi, being investigated?
Well, certainly, let's use the word advisor in the loosest of terms. Mm-hmm. She has no government role and never has. She was in Europe for the past 2 months. She came back to Seoul over the weekend. Today, she met with prosecutors who grilled her about her role in perhaps giving her advice on policy. She's also being questioned about embezzlement. She runs a couple foundations where she has been able to convince the biggest companies in South Korea, including Samsung, to give many millions of dollars. And she's accused of running off with some of those funds. She appeared looking rather frail, saying that she had committed a deadly sin. Her lawyer later said that that was not an admission to guilt. She just feels very bad about all the turmoil here in South Korea.
So how hard is this scandal impacting President Park?
Well, President Park has already dismissed much of her inner office, chief of staff. Whether or not she actually steps down, that, of course, remains to be seen. Although I'd say it's unlikely. And what her own party seems to be calling for is that they want her to relinquish some of her responsibilities to a new prime minister. And much of the goings on of government, the day-to-day business, would be conducted in the National Assembly by a new prime minister.
Is it likely that'll happen?
Well, she's in pretty bad shape right now. Even her own party has seemed to turn on her, not to mention the opposition party that has been looking for any way to take her down over the past few years. So she might be pushed into a corner if she wants to keep her job.
Reporter Jason Strother in Seoul. Thanks very much for your time, Jason.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
Let's shift our focus to Brazilian politics now. Rio de Janeiro seems like one of the most liberal, gay-friendly cities on the planet. From the outside, anyway, and yet it's just elected a right-wing evangelical leader as its new mayor. Senator Marcelo Crivella easily beat his socialist opponent, taking 59% of the votes in a runoff election. The World's Will Carlos in Rio has been following the story.
Marcelo Crivella is a right-wing conservative pastor who spent much of the last 10 years working actually in Africa. He took this big Brazilian Pentecostal church to Africa, opened a whole series of churches there, and then came back and is now making his political, not debut, as you mentioned, he's been a senator. This is his first big posting.
Yeah, and my image, as I said, of Rio, it's a pretty liberal place. Why did Crivella get elected now?
First of all, that's something of a misnomer. I mean, we have two very different cities in Rio, the liberal area, the sort of elite area in the south of Rio, and then you have the west and the north of Rio, where it's a very conservative place. And certainly the LGBT activists that I spoke to said, look, this is still a dangerous city in which to be openly gay. There's still a lot of violence directed, even during the carnival, towards the gay community. So that's certainly part of it.
Yeah, I know you spoke with several members of the LGBT community in Rio. What are they saying?
Well, let me introduce Jandira Quiroz. So I spoke to her and I asked her whether she saw Marcelo Crivella as something of a wolf in sheep's clothing.
I don't see the sheep's clothing on him. He's a wolf. I think he represents very risky climate that is going on and growing really fast in Brazilian society. It's not only in Rio at all. If you look at other states, the same is going on as well.
Wow, and not even sheep's clothing Crivella is the wolf. What about that notion that other parts of Brazil are becoming more conservative? True?
The broader context of this is that we're coming out of 12 years now of rule by the very leftist Workers' Party. And Brazil's had this disastrous economy, these huge corruption scandals over the last year or so. And that's really led to the complete and utter downfall of the left wing. The idea is that this sort of arch-conservative, very strong evangelical movement is going to try and step into that vacuum. And we're seeing that with people like Crivella, who many people think is sort of the tip of the spear, and that we're going to see a lot more of these candidates coming forwards all over Brazil.
Also, Will, I've been told that Crivella is a nephew of the founder of the Universal Church of the Kingdom of God, the main Pentecostal church in Brazil. How big is the Pentecostal church, and is the new mayor of Rio emblematic of, you know, the rise of these churches?
He very much says that he's not. He's really tried to distance himself from the church, which it should be said has been the subject of huge investigations into money laundering and corruption and all sorts of other stuff. I mean, this is a very powerful, a very wealthy church. Actually, one of the big controversies of this election campaign was a tape that surfaced of Crivella saying, we've already got the people, we've already got the money, now what we need is the political influence so that we can really take over. He's talking about the evangelical movement.
Well, one acid test of the growth of evangelical churches is the appearance of these mega church buildings. You see that in Africa a lot. Kind of interesting that Senator Crivella tested out his evangelism in Africa. Any mega churches yet in Brazil that are, say, bigger than Rio's Maracanã Stadium? Because that wouldn't that be the tipping point of Brazil, where the churches are bigger than the biggest soccer stadium?
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm not sure about the exact size and numbers, but certainly, I mean, I live in a nice middle-class neighborhood in Rio, and right on the oceanfront in prime real estate, there is one of these evangelical church buildings. You really can't go a few blocks in Brazil without seeing one of these big churches.
The world's Will Carlos in Rio. Thanks very much, Will.
Thank you.
News headlines are coming up next here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. The United Arab Emirates. It's really sunny there and hot.
Everyone in the UAE gets from their air-conditioned condo into an air-conditioned car, goes off to the air-conditioned office directly parking. They don't even walk outside for a few minutes.
And that means many Emiratis aren't getting enough vitamin D. That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. It is 61 days until the end of the year, but my time horizon right now is starting today, 8 days, as in who will this country elect as president in 8 days. More than 21 million Americans have already voted, casting early ballots, and for some of them, this is their first election, a milestone in any American's life, a big milestone for new Americans especially. All this week, we'll be hearing from first-time voters, and today we hear from singer Lila Downs. She's Mexican-American, known for her political and socially engaged tunes. This election prompted her to write a new protest song called The Demagogue. There's a blue-eyed devil man, thinks he's king of the world. Yep, it's clear who Lila Downs does not want for president. For a singer who has roots in both Minnesota and Oaxaca, and is political, I was surprised to learn that this is the first American election she's voting in. But this time you felt a need to engage. So what was it this time around?
I really did. And, you know, the curious thing is I also voted in Mexico for the first time. I guess that I never really had faith in the system and kind of rebellious all my life. I am taking it more serious this time, thinking about it in the bigger picture as a social movement and as an expression of our movements all over the world. And like schools of fish, we turn that way and we turn the other way depending on what is convenient for us, or sometimes we just intuit. It's not even very thought out.
You know, I recently met some Americans who live along the border in Arizona, and the idea that Mexican immigration has actually dropped while Central Americans fleeing violence are increasing and coming to this country, they're getting deported in greater numbers. These truths don't really seem to matter to people who live along the border. Now, your music aims in part to talk about these realities, but how do you connect with audiences if they simply don't believe or hear what's going on in the world?
Well, I guess that we have our audiences as a performer, as a singer-songwriter, and sometimes, yes, we do feel like we're just preaching to the choir and we are not, you know, stepping out a bit. I feel like I had the responsibility to write a song about this that angered me very much and made me think of pre-Hitler times, and so I wrote a song about it. And we should not take this lightly, but if there are a lot of people who are not conscious of those things and are younger and have, you know, the same thing kind of happened in Mexico at one point, the same party that had been in government for, you know, most of our recent history came back, and there were a lot of younger voters and
you're
so
talking about the PRI, the institutional ruling party there.
Yeah, the PRI, exactly.
Sorry, the Red Institutional Revolutionary Party.
Now they're looking at what this leadership has been like, and I think they are very disappointed. So maybe some of these people are right. I mean, maybe it won't. Maybe it'll be kind of bad, but maybe not as bad as we're thinking. And I hope for the best. I have faith in humanity. I think I'm not a pessimist.
Lila Downs' most recent song is called The Demagogue. Lila, where will you be voting?
I already did, because I live in Mexico now.
The absentee ballot already
yes.
Mailed. Lila Downs, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
And I pray to the ancestors' love tonight.
And we'll be hearing the voices of more first-time voters all this week.
The serpent woke again in different times and places.
So I turned on my heater for the first time last week. Hey, first frost. I don't like to admit it, but winter is creeping up on us here in the Northeast. This means more time indoors and less time to soak up the sunlight that helps our bodies make vitamin D. But here's the thing. Even in one of the sunniest places on Earth, it can be hard to get enough vitamin D. This is a serious issue in the United Arab Emirates. Some reports say 75 to 80% of Emiratis are vitamin D deficient. The world's Shirin Jafari went there to find out why.
Here's a typical exchange between me and my guide in the UAE. We get into the car after spending a few minutes outside.
AC.
Yeah, seriously. I'm just like dripping sweat.
Me too.
It's hot. And it's not even in the summer. Not even in the hottest month. If there's one thing you know about the UAE, it's probably that there's a ton of sunlight. Maybe too much, some might say. So why all the vitamin D deficiency?
It's very nice to meet you.
Dr. Humaira Badsha is a rheumatologist in Dubai. She sees this in her patients all the time.
When people ask me this question, how can it be that there's so much vitamin D deficiency in a sunny country? Then I ask them back, how much time do you actually spend outside?
Very little, apparently.
Everyone in the UAE gets from their air-conditioned condo or a flat into an air-conditioned car with tinted glasses sometimes, and then goes off to their air-conditioned office directly parking. They don't even walk outside for a few minutes. It's a lifestyle which doesn't promote that kind of being outside.
Not just that. She says it's also the way people dress here.
And it's not just the traditional dress of the hijab, but also Asian and other South Asian women who live here, they wear long conservative clothing. And it's a cultural practice not for them to spend time in the sun, not to suntan, you know, they don't like to tan.
Lina Amiri is one of the Emirati women who wears the traditional clothing called the abaya. She found out recently that she's not getting enough vitamin D.
When I got the diagnosis, it made sense. I feel lazy all the time, sleepy all the time, body aches, and these are symptoms that are associated with vitamin D deficiency.
Amiri says other women in her family suffer from this too.
My mom, who was diagnosed with vitamin D deficiency, was for the longest time tired, and nobody knew what was wrong with her. She would fall asleep in the middle of a meal, forgetful and all of these things. And then when she went to a doctor after like prolonged suffering, then she was diagnosed to have vitamin D deficiency. Once that was corrected, everything changed.
I met Amiri through her husband, Dr. Hassan Galadari, a dermatologist in Dubai. He worries about the high number of people who suffer from vitamin D deficiency in the UAE, but there's something else that worries him, the way some tanning salons have been taking advantage of this in their ads.
You open any magazine, you see all these tanning salon advertisements and so forth, and some of them actually mention vitamin D and so forth where they can.
Tanning salons in the UAE? I wanted to know more.
You're so beautiful.
So I went to visit one called Megasun. Marlene Armamento works there.
I just started with Megasun last year. And I was like, really? A tanning salon in Middle East?
Yeah. How do you make a pitch for a tanning salon in a place like Dubai? Come get your vitamin D in the privacy of a salon and in a fraction of the time you would need to spend out in the sun.
We actually have two types of machines.
Armamento shows me around the place. There are three rooms. Each has a tanning bed the size of a couch. They look like spaceships.
Oh, it says vitamin D on the door.
Yes.
Vitamin D for your life.
Sure, I'm thinking. Vitamin D for your life. Vafar Rais is convinced. She's a loyal customer of Megasun. She's wearing thick black mascara and shiny lip gloss.
I try to come once a week if I don't get like natural sun and I don't get time, honestly, to go to the beach. One, two, it's way too hot. So here it's a lot safer to come into these tanning beds and it's less time consuming.
For Rais, this is a good way to get a tan and some vitamin D. Galadari, the dermatologist, though, is very skeptical.
First of all, they're not going to get their vitamin D because it doesn't contain UVB, which really is the one that plays a role in the production and the metabolism of vitamin D. In addition, they're basically risking. UVA has a huge problem, causes a lot of problems that can lead to skin cancer at the end of the day.
Dr. Batra, the rheumatologist, says a better solution would be for the UAE to do what the US and some European countries have done.
So in Western countries, they actually put vitamin D supplementation into milk, into eggs, into certain foods which people commonly consume.
This, she says, is a more realistic approach, rather than asking patients to spend more time outdoors or change the way they dress. Amiri, the Emirati woman who was diagnosed recently, says the supplements she's been taking have made all the difference. She feels a lot more energized, for example. And now, anytime someone in the family feels sluggish, she knows what to ask.
Did you check the vitamin D level? This is the first thing.
And with that, I leave Amiri as she sits in her air-conditioned office and dash off to the air-conditioned car waiting for me outside to take me to my air-conditioned hotel. For the World, Shirin Jafari, United Arab Emirates.
Here in the Boston area, one popular spot to be on Halloween is Salem. Lots of witch costumes on parade there every year, you know, because of those witch trials way back when. If you're in Spain on Halloween, the place to visit is the ghost town of La Musara. It's an old remote settlement that's been abandoned since the mid-20th century. Visitors talk about its thick, disorienting fog and eerie experiences among the ruins. Reporter Amanda Kersey couldn't resist checking it out.
To find the facts behind the fiction, I start by talking to someone who's actually been there.
I think that when you don't know a place, people tell you things like it's mysterious or whatever, but you don't really pay much attention to it.
That's Catalan musician Carles Ribot. He went to La Musara with a friend a few years ago, having heard that the views were out of this world, and that by jumping over a certain rock into a hidden portal, he could be, too.
Pero dicen que apareces en Estados Unidos.
They say you appear in the United States. I don't remember where exactly, but it's on the internet.
They made the mistake, he says, of driving to La Musara at night, in the fog.
Mucha niebla y pensábamos que no llegaríamos.
We thought we weren't going to make it. I thought, here we're going to die or something.
But they made it. They settled into the inn, Refugi La Musara. It's kind of a bunkhouse for the climbers, hikers, and supernatural seekers who pass through. Everything was fine until they went to bed. It was a little past midnight.
And you could hear the horses' cries. A sound like... Like something sinister. Yeah, not a joke.
I have to see it for myself. But I'm definitely not going alone.
How are you feeling about this?
About what?
Going? Climbing the mountain?
Ah, wow, I'm really excited.
That's my friend, Paul Fonbote Pradilla. He's a history buff who speaks the regional language, Catalan. He agrees to come with me to La Musara, which means driving up a narrow mountain road with a lot of tight turns.
Oh my gosh. At least it's not dark.
I'm so relieved when we get there. There being the only shelter for miles. The innkeeper, Miquel Cardona, shows us around. I keep thinking about those creepy sounds Ribot heard here, and I ask Cardona if that sort of spooky experience is common.
There's a lot of people who've come to the inn and said that they've heard sounds or have seen shadows. Who am I to doubt someone who tells me they've seen something, you know?
It's dusk by the time we start exploring the ruins of the old town. There's no fog tonight, which we're a little disappointed about. Still, there's plenty of atmosphere. Mountains all around, the plains below, the Mediterranean in the distance.
Surely we're going to see some ghosts.
Walking around, we can't tell where the streets used to be. Everything is overgrown, and all the houses have fallen down.
Oh, yeah, those are not stairs anymore.
And rising above it all, the decrepit, vandalized church.
Oof, we are not going in there. No.
All in all, though, this rubble of a town is more serene than scary. And back at the inn, we and the other guests thankfully have a quiet, uneventful night. The next morning, Paul and I go back to get a better look at La Musara, which by day is plainly bucolic. There are kids playing around the pond, a couple exploring the site, a group of men taking a stroll. But the innkeeper tells me that a decidedly different crowd will settle in this Monday night.
¿Qué pasa en Halloween?
Vale, sí, me preguntaba sobre el día de Halloween.
For a few years now on Halloween, people have been coming in caravans and in groups. Those who do EVP recordings of ghostly sounds, those who do rituals, and also you hear screams through the night, like when people scare each other. The environment is something between magical and scary, yeah, a bit of everything.
I can't believe I'm going to miss the one time a year when the town lives up to its reputation. Too bad we can't stay. As we head off for that crazy drive down the mountain, I think, what better way to go out than with a song from Carles Ribot's Musara. For The World, Amanda Kersey, La Musara, Spain.
Paga per un paisatge nevat, reflexiu i preocupat pel futur de la societat.
For years, she was a rebel fighter in the Colombian jungle. Now she's struggling with her transition to a new life. That story from Colombia, just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Peace officially fell short in Colombia last month after a slim majority of Colombians rejected a peace deal between the government and leftist FARC guerrillas. Now the country is trying to figure out another way to end its 52-year civil war, and it's going to require a special focus on women. There are over 17,000 armed rebel fighters in Colombia. By some estimates, 40% of them are women. Some have spent most of their lives fighting. The government wants them to transition back to civilian life, but that's not so easy. This week, as part of our Across Women's Lives project, we're taking a look at what decades of war in Colombia have meant for women. Reporter Jasmine Garst starts off by visiting one former guerrilla who's struggling.
Before I hit the record button, the woman I'm about to interview, Xiomara, has two requests. First, that she not be asked to say anything bad about the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC, for whom she fought for 15 years. Second, she wants you to know she was honorably discharged. She didn't just quit. Okay, now that's out of the way. I meet Xiomara in an enormous shanty town near the Colombian Amazon, where thousands of families displaced by war live. Xiomara's not her real name. She asked us to keep her anonymous. To get to her house, I have to climb down an incredibly steep stairway into a concrete glen. Her husband runs a store out of the front, and every so often, someone will interrupt us for a cigarette or green plantains, which are sold out, by the way. In between customers, Xiomara reminisces about when she first became a militant. She was 14 years old. She didn't tell her friends or her family that she was leaving.
Desde niña, me gustaban las armas. Yo decía que si yo no era del ejército, de la policía.
Ever since I was a little girl, I loved guns. I figured I would join the police or the army. But to join the army, you have to study. And I was really poor, so the easiest thing was the guerrillas. It didn't require you to study.
People join the FARC for different reasons. For many, it's ideological. For some, like Xiomara, it's about adventure. And for a lot of women, it's about getting respect.
The FARC espoused a rhetoric of gender equality.
Kimberly Tyden, a professor at Tufts University, teaches international humanitarian studies and has worked in Colombia. She says, for all their promises, women had it pretty rough in the FARC.
Then you hear about the forced abortions and forced contraception and being forced to sleep with people that you did not necessarily want to, giving up babies that you wished you could raise.
Xiomara stiffens when I ask if it was ever scary out there.
Well, it's a hard life. I'm not going to tell you it's all happiness and celebration. No, I was scared because it's scary. You know, at any moment, a bullet can hit you and kill you. That's scary. But look, you learn. I'm telling you, you get used to it. You get used to it and you learn.
But she loved it. She says she moved throughout Colombia, mountains and jungle, until she started getting sick. She blames the birth control the rebel doctors gave her. She says the hormones made her really ill. It got so bad the FARC discharged her.
They told me I was no longer of use and I could no longer do it anyways. It was as far as I could go.
She left the wilderness and went home to her niece's house while she figured out her next move.
I was scared of going outside, very scared. And I'm not going to lie, I still am. I'm not scared of getting hurt. I don't feel at ease because it's like I'm a little mountain animal. A mountain animal.
That's when she enrolled in an official reintegration program run by the Colombian government with support from the U.S. government. It starts off with a halfway house.
We were treated very well, very well.
About 48,000 former militants from different armed factions have enrolled in the program in the last 12 years. It gives you counseling and a stipend in exchange for continuing your education or learning a trade. Xiomara is finishing her high school degree. She's learned to do things that at first were terrifying, booking a doctor's appointment, speaking to clerks at the bank. But the scariest thing, the one she still cannot figure out, is how to be a woman in Colombian society.
One of the things that's been hard for me is to break the habit of traveling a lot. I'd like to still do that, but now I can never leave the house. I want to travel. I want to go somewhere. I want to leave. I'll be fine. And then from 1 minute to the next, I want to get out. I just want to go. I want out. I need to leave. And I can't because I have a home now.
Here's the thing. Colombian society is very gendered. Women aren't supposed to travel and get dirty. What Xiomara is describing is one of the big challenges for reintegrating female rebels. For years, they've been experiencing adrenaline and even adventure. And now they're supposed to slide back into traditional roles. Xiomara feels it in her body, still strong from hiking around the country with a weapon, but growing soft from sitting around tending the store. Here's Professor Tyden again.
I think the program has understood you're demobilizing men because armed men are seen as a security risk. The message to the women is re-domesticate. Let's get you back into the lipstick, back into the home, back into, and it's a very reactionary, backward-looking kind of understanding of what these women may be wanting after years of having seen themselves as political actors and protagonists.
If Colombia manages to sign a peace deal with the rebel forces, it would be historic. The longest active war on this side of the planet would be over. But Professor Tyden says in order for any peace deal to work, the government will have to rethink how it helps female combatants come back.
La verdad, usted quiere que yo le diga la verdad?
The truth? You want me to tell you the honest truth?
Yo sí extraño esa vida.
I miss that life.
Esa es la verdad.
That's the truth.
Xiomara doesn't venture out of the house much. She married a sweet, mild-mannered man. She says he's her only friend. She says to relax, she watches television.
I smoke also. I learned to smoke there. I came back with that bad habit. I've tried to quit for a while, and then I go back to it.
I tell her that I sneak in a cigarette once in a while, and she smiles. She invites me to the back of the house, a porch overlooking a canal. The water's dirty, but it's peaceful out here. And for a few minutes, her husband isn't hovering over us, which is when she tells me just how sick she got before she left the wilderness.
Por eso no puedo tener familia.
And that's why I can't have kids.
And this weighs so heavily on Xiomara. Dusk has fallen, and it's time for me to go. Xiomara has one last request.
Why are you leaving so soon? Why don't you stay longer?
So I stay for another cigarette. And then I really have to get going. For The World, Jasmine Garst, Colombia.
Tomorrow, Jasmine introduces us to a former guerrilla for whom the FARC was an escape from domestic violence. Now she's starting a new life. I hope you'll tune in for that. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.